Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han and I'm here once again with my co-host Tim Hemming for another Brexit News Review. What have you got for us today, Tim?
So much Brexit news today, Jen.
All of the Brexit news in our
weirdly soothing Brexit podcast.
Yes, that's right. Indeed, we were featured on an Esquire list of the, I believe it was 45 best podcasts you need to listen to now. So you will be pleased to know that you are on a must-listen podcast at the moment. So do stay tuned to listen to this.
Essential listening. Who do you think is weirdly soothing, me or you?
I would like to say it's me.
Okay.
Just fine. For selfish reasons.
Take it. Okay.
I will take it.
So we're going to do our weekly news format now. Ever so popular. And I'm picking up on five discussion points from the last week. And boy, oh boy, has there been a lot of Brexit-related news. Well, just general news, I suppose, that relates to Brexit. Kind of the same thing. My first one, have a listen to this.
That's very dramatic.
Yeah, should we cut that there?
Maybe.
of course,
much for soothing.
Of course, Le Marseillais, the French national anthem. And we're playing that because Emmanuel Macron, who took two-thirds of the vote last night to steamroller Marine Le Pen in the French elections. Perhaps we should have been playing the EU national anthem, though, which is what he played, didn't he, in his victory parade, which probably underlines slightly where his loyalties lie.
It definitely does, yeah.
Mr. Macron, the centrist.
So definitely no need to worry there then that France might have its own independence referendum.
Well, not immediately. It's not quite as straightforward as that. I'm going to come into a few of the points and discuss what the French election means to Brexit in a second. One piece of correlation in terms of the voting patterns, and this held true for the Brexit referendum, the Dutch election and the US presidential presidential election, is that the biggest correlating factor is areas of education. Macron won 84% of the vote in the top 10 most educated communes. I was thinking about this whole idea about education and people voting for feeling much more European with levels of education. Is it probably just more about the correlation to wealth so that people are then happy with the status quo because they're happy with their lot at the moment so they don't want change?
Well, I don't think that's true because I think wealth was one of their measurements as well, and that didn't quite correspond as much as education did. It's not like because you have a high level of education that automatically equals that you have a higher level of income.
No, not automatically, but I would say there's probably quite a high correlation within that. And I think it was the blue-collar workers that feel disaffected, and they're the ones that voted for Le Pen.
But the thing is, it's not like all of these polls weren't also examined for income and class, and that wasn't as much of a correlating factor as education. So I still think that while class did play a role, which no one is doubting, I think clearly education is the more distinctive one.
Le Pen has been quite panned in a way for her performance, but I'm not sure that really holds true. In 2012, she didn't make the runoff, but she did get 17.9% of the vote. In 2017, she got 21.3% of the first round vote. The Front National are making some advances here.
Definitely.
Do it 5 years' time, then. And potentially we could have Marion Maréchal Le Pen, the 27-year-old niece, who's more hardline than Marine. She could be taking up the baton.
Loving the pseudo French accent, Tim.
Do you like that?
Yeah, I do. I've been working on it all morning. Have you? Mm. We touched on this on our episode on the French election, actually, and our guest Vincent Pons was saying that he thinks as well that if Macron is not able to deliver significant economic improvement during his tenure. That's just going to give the Fond National more to work on, even if it's basically impossible for him to achieve that economic
And it could be uptick. Very, very hard for him to do that. The big unemployment as well as national security are the two biggies for him. Now, he names his prime minister on the 15th, but he's come from nothing. So he then has to find 577 candidates for all the constituencies around France. There's no guarantee that they will get elected. So therefore, he may have to put somebody from the opposition in as his prime minister, at which point all his plans could be completely stymied.
Yeah, and then the entire process stalls, and then that just sort of adds fuel to the fire of the Front National. So
it's watch this space to find out if Macron is on march, as is with the exclamation mark, as his new party is.
I think, yeah, on march.
As for Brexit, we need to bring this back to Brexit, and I thought, let's see what Macron really thinks of Brexit. We know he's quite pro-euro, so I thought the way to do this was to see not what he's going to say now, because we know he's a trained actor from his wife and he's very good in terms of his linguistic skills, and he's going to play the diplomat, and once you've won power there is this feeling of bringing everybody together and not upsetting anyone. So let's turn the clock back a little bit and find out what Macron previously thought of Brexit. I love to say Macron as much as possible. And he said previously, it's a crime for which Britain should be punished by total exit. I don't want a sort of tailor-made approach where the Brits will have better of the two worlds. Otherwise, it will be a big incentive for all members of the club to leave or to kill the European ideas. The European ideas are based on common responsibility and solidarity. And that's the critical point, especially when you speak about immigration.
So that's a bit more of a hardline approach then. I think we will have to wait and see how he then goes on to interact with the other EU leaders and how that forms as a collaborative.
We know how Marine Le Pen thinks he's going to react. She's quite witty when she said that after the election, a woman will certainly be running France, either herself or Angela Merkel.
Well, that is witty indeed. That does... Is that a redeeming quality? Do we like Marine Le Pen now because she was a bit witty?
Well, I think it's witty. And, but that is the point, right? And I was looking at some of the Brexit-related feedback off the election result. Nigel Farage, for example. A giant deceit has been voted for today. Macron will be Juncker's puppet. So, you know, they just think he's effectively going to... fall into line. And the Twitter account of leave.eu, which is the pro-Brexit pressure group set up by Farage, went very, very strongly to say that the French people had once again rolled over, just as they had done in 1940 to Germany. So,
wow.
Ouch.
That is...
Strong feelings. Watch this space, though, I think, on France, because things are going to develop quite quickly and we'll see how much...
And obviously, inevitably, they will have an effect on Brexit.
Yeah. Should we move it on?
Yes.
Point two.
Go on then.
More election chatter.
All of the elections.
There's not enough elections. we should run our own party, call it the election party.
Just for the sake of it.
A vote every other week. The news that came out of the local elections, the local council elections in the UK, that the Tories were making huge gains. Labour were being panned. Tories were making big gains. Therefore, it's a precursor of what's going to happen in the general election. But just doing a bit of digging, I'm not so sure that is the case.
Okay.
Couple of reasons. Only 35% of people bothered to turn out for local council elections.
Okay.
So
do we have any estimates yet of what the turnout might be for this one, I'm assuming?
What, for the general election?
Mm.
Well, it's going to be higher than that, I would hope.
I would hope.
Yeah.
Higher than 35%.
Yeah, it's hard to know whether people do have election fatigue or whether people are going to be... And whether people are going to be empowered to bring home the votes for this. I have a sense that the more it's talked about that the Tories are going to go for a landslide, the more... I don't know. Does that empower the opposition or people that want to vote something different? Does that make them get up and vote? Or do they think they've got no chance? It's a very kind of like psychological argument, couldn't it?
Yeah, because I feel like that was the entire issue before the Brexit referendum as well. Because it's
you expect something to happen.
Yeah, everyone expected Remain, and then is it the fact that everyone expected it that in the end empowered Leave? I don't really know.
No.
It should be quite interesting to see.
Yeah. The other thing is that they had an 11-point lead in the council elections, and there's the Tories, that is. The Tories did over Labour. The school of thought, Tories benefited from UKIP, who were, to be frank, decimated, down 18 points to just 5%.
That's a sliver of hope, I suppose, at least.
Sliver of hope for whom?
For me.
Right.
For the fact that UKIP is now...
If anyone's not been listening to the past 65 episodes of the show, Jen's not a massive fan of UKIP, but we do try and stay...
Impartial
in our weirdly soothing way.
I am acknowledging my bias. At least I'm not pretending that I'm impartial, so you know what my opinion is and you may disagree or agree.
Yeah, is this the death knell for UKIP? I don't know, but that's quite a drop off. Just back to the point, though, before we move on to point three. They've got an 11-point lead in the council elections. There was a sense that they, at the moment they've got a 17-point lead in the national opinion polls. So they are a way off just going off the local council elections. So what they really need to have that landslide to give May her mandate to take to Brussels, which is we are all united for Brexit. Which brings me to point three. Strong and stable leadership.
Wow, this is news. We've not heard that one before, have we?
It's not news, but the
sorry.
It's not news. It's a repeated mantra of the Tory party. Yeah. For anybody who's not heard about strong and stable leadership multiple times over the past couple of weeks. The point is that I wanted to pick up on was Theresa May, our Prime Minister, of course, is very clear that she feels she needs a strong mandate to take to Brussels, so we have a strong bargaining position when it comes to Brexit negotiation talks. Now, there's an interesting piece from Yanis Varoufakis, who was the Greece's ex-finance minister, I believe. He's an interesting fella to speak to. He's actually got a new book out, and the piece that I looked at was on The Guardian. It's taken from his new book. It's an adapted extract from Adults in the Room, My Battle with Europe's Deep Establishment, by Yanis Varoufakis. I'll say that name once more. It's in The Guardian, typically a left-leaning newspaper. I thought it made it quite interesting in some ways, because this is certainly not a pro-EU piece. And he recounts what happened when he tried to lead Greece's attempt to negotiate with the European Union a couple of years ago. And he looks at six reasons why Theresa May, when she comes up against the likes of Juncker, will really struggle. So he starts off his article, or his piece in his book, which is a tweet by Duncan Robinson, who's the Brussels correspondent for the Financial Times. Brits fallen for Greek fallacy that domestic vote gives you a strong position in Brussels. Other countries have voters too. Yanis' point is that Brussels is a democracy-free zone administering a heavy industrial cartel. Now, he's obviously been quite scarred by his own dealings with them. So he's basically saying that no voters in any country can empower their government to oppose Brussels. So for all the concerns with rules, treaties, processes, competitiveness, freedom of movement, terrorism, etc., only one prospect truly terrifies EU's deep establishment. And do you know what that is, Jen?
Money?
Democracy.
Oh.
Democracy, according to Yanis. So the reasons why Theresa May is going to be in trouble when she comes to negotiations is because she's simply going to get the runaround. None of her questions are going to get answered, and they'll just be delaying tactics.
That's an optimistic view.
He's citing this from his experience.
Yeah. Okay.
He would pick up the phone to somebody, make a call, and then rather than be responded to, they would then respond to a different member of the Greek government and completely bypass him. Any research he ever provided on economic models to say this is the way that we should deal with Greece's mounting debt, he felt were just dismissed out of hand. And when he did put things forward, he felt he was completely stymied by stalling and fact-finding missions that needed to take place. is a really damning piece in many ways. And this bit was quite interesting when he says that debt relief was always top of Greece's agenda, but Brussels and Berlin first insisted that they needed to have a compromise in place before they would discuss debt relief. And we know
Theresa... Compromise on?
They would compromise on exactly what Greece's standing in the European Union was going to be.
Okay.
And then, and what he's saying, he needs, what Yanis was trying to do was set something up for debt relief first, because that was a really pressing, kind of pernicious situation for Greece as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
However, he couldn't go into that. They would only do it, negotiate it one thing at a time. They wouldn't do it concurrently.
Okay.
And this is an argument that we start to see playing out with Britain and Brexit.
Yeah.
Because Theresa May wants to bring on the different discussions all at the same time. Talk about the trade agreement, for example. Whereas Brussels is saying, well, no, stop. We need to negotiate what's going to happen in terms of the exit plan first.
Okay, so there are some parallels there, basically.
There is from him, yeah. Yeah, and what does he advocate? Varoufakis advocates that Britain requests from Brussels a Norway-style, off-the-shelf arrangement for a period of 7 years.
How likely do we think that is?
Well, I don't think it's very likely. But he argues that both Eurocrats, Europhiles, have no basis then for denying Britain such an arrangement, because it still keeps everything kind of happy in the EU. And he also, interestingly...
They do have a basis for it, because the whole point is that if the UK gets a deal that's then... equal or better to being in the EU, that then encourages other people to leave. So really there is some form of motivation to not allow Britain to have that kind of deal.
Yeah, but I think he's saying it's keeping things on ice rather.
Right, so it's not just a permanent
deal. No, as in terms of it's not going to happen within this quick 2-year period where everybody's interest may not be served.
Okay.
That's his argument. But he also says, and this is kind of an interesting point, that the likes of Merkel would be quite relieved about it, because the ball would be thrown into their successor's court 7 years down the track. So they wouldn't necessarily have to deal with that. Yeah, and also give sovereignty back to the House of Commons to some degree. So he's an interesting fella. Yanis Varoufakis, I recommend people have a look at some of his stuff.
Okay. What's Point the four. Last one then?
Got two more.
Two more. Okay, fourth one.
I'm on a roll today. The fourth point is the NHS crisis. And there's been a few news pieces today which have caught the headlines, and that's to do with NHS nurses giving up their jobs to go and work in supermarkets.
Yeah. And going to food banks to get food.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So... And at the same, in terms of the Brexit side of that, hospitals are struggling to make up the shortfall with staff from overseas. So there is a problem there. I noticed the UKIP, a fast diminishing UKIP, announced their one in one out policy today. But the National Audit Office previously said that the NHS is short of 50,000 frontline clinical staff. So the NHS struggles on.
Yeah.
It really does need massive support, doesn't it?
Which it's unlikely to get under the Tories, should they be re-elected, I suppose.
Although Theresa May did promise a lot more support for mental health services, which was, again, criticised by the Liberals for saying that perhaps she hadn't done enough sooner, which is pretty much what I took from that.
Okay. Well, it's not like the Conservatives particularly have a good track record of investing in the NHS.
No, well, that's kind of... That's why... That's, I guess that's the Labour and the Liberal policy, isn't it?
To say
that's why you should vote for us. And very finally, previous guest on the show, Mr. Robert Watts, yesterday, the compiler of the Sunday Times Rich List, had the Sunday Times Rich List out yesterday, and it's a fine statement of record of the rich, I suppose, I'm going to say the great and the good of the UK, but actually just people have got obscene amount of money. Have a guess how much money you need to get on the Rich List this year.
My God, I don't know.
To get in the top 1,000, £110 million. So I reckon if we carry on with this podcast for another few years, we will...
we'll be sorted.
Yeah, especially if we go down another 7 years, as is Yanis's recommendation, we could just string this thing out for a long time. Anyway, I slightly digress.
110 million.
Guess how much impact you think Brexit has had on the super rich?
None.
Absolutely. Very, very little impact. It's not really top of the agenda. But interestingly, Rob says that the notion that they are all remainers is complete bunk. And actually, they are risk takers who thrive on change, not hate it.
Okay. That sounds like a euphemism if I've ever heard one. Risk takers. Although I suppose I was going to say they must be able to take risks to some extent to make that amount of money, but then a lot of it's inheritance, surely. So, don't know about risk takers. It's really.
Actually not so much. I mean, there is some old money still knocking around, but there are many people on the rich list who came out of the school with no qualifications whatsoever.
Really?
Yep. And it's not all people who work in, who lead, you know, run FTSE 100 companies, for example. There are people there that have pulled themselves up from their bootstraps and owns chains of garages. There are people in, you know, traditional trade, engineering and the like, that you perhaps wouldn't necessarily expect. I think, looking at Rob's editorial on it, it's incredibly varied. And looking at who is a UK billionaire in this day and age is not that hard to predict. It's quite hard to predict, rather. It also feels utterly obscene, the amounts of money.
Yeah, can't even picture it.
No.
Can't even imagine it. Obviously, Brexit wouldn't make a dent in that then. Because, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of it that isn't cash values that would be affected by Brexit. It's probably property, which I suppose got affected slightly.
The weakening pound, he argues, brings up quite a lot of... is helpful for a lot of them in terms of their overseas assets.
So the complete opposite then, basically. Okay.
And that's pretty much it from me for this week's roundup.
Thank you for tuning in for another episode of the Brexit Podcast News Roundup. I've been your host, Jennifer Han, with my co-host, Tim Hemming. And you can find us on all the social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.